Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for April 2013. You know, we're having a virtual epidemic, what I call almost a silent epidemic, of an issue that's very, very serious in our global healthcare community, and that's blindness in the adult population. And it's not congenital blindness. This is what I would call induced blindness through what has often been termed age-related macular degeneration. We're very fortunate this month to have a world expert in the area of ocular health and ophthalmological research guide us through this extraordinarily interesting and tortuous field of visual acuity, retinal pathology, and how it interrelates with this rising tide of blindness. Very, very serious issue. You know, as you talk to older people, they'll often say, if the quality of my life is so depreciated that I'm not enjoying it, then it really marginally evaluates whether going forward is worth it. And one of those things is sight as a virtuous and important function as we grow older. That with memory, as you'll talk with seniors in settings where there's common communication among people of geriatric age about concerns they have. Vision and memory, they keep coming back and back as very, very important areas of concern. And these are the areas that are most often impacting older age people, particularly in institutional settings and in various community living situations, in which there's a lot of sadness about the loss of vision and the loss of memory that's seen among older age individuals who are still looking to have some great days ahead in their lives. So what's the cause of this ever-increasing source of acute age-related macular degeneration and ocular injury that's so serious that vision is impaired, ultimately leading to blindness? I call this collateral damage, and it interrelates with insulin resistance and oxidative stress and the many topics that we have talked about in Functional Medicine Update over the last 30-plus years. In fact, it might be considered the poster child for the outcome from what happens over the course of living of decades where insulin has not been able to properly manage glucose, oxidative stress and mitochondrial bioenergetics is uncoupled and enhanced, and glycation, which is the connection of glucose to various proteins and the activation of inflammatory response, has been going on for decades until, in the eyes of a individual, the macula starts to undergo degeneration. The ophthalmologist predicts that this particular process will lead ultimately to blindness, and the best therapeutic tools we have in terms of pharmacology and surgery are not able to hold back the tide against these processes. So this sounds like lifestyle medicine. It sounds like functional medicine, and it's exactly, I think, as I said, a poster child for this kind of an intervention. And the collateral damage is injury to the eyes, as you're going to be hearing from our extraordinary researcher, clinician of the month, who is an expert in the ophthalmological science, relate to these conditions, both from a biochemical perspective with his PhD in biochemistry and chemistry and his medical doctorate and specialization in the field of ophthalmological surgery and ophthalmology as it pertains to a basic science. So let's, in preparation for this discussion with Dr. Kishal, talk a little bit about what we have known and what we have learned. And I think this is a very interesting topic that takes us back to a period that some of you might remember if you've been in this field for some time and been following Functional Medicine Update, because it's been part of our discussions that we've been having since the late 80s. But there was a very important paper that appeared in 1994 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it was entitled Dietary Carotenoids, Vitamins A, C, and E, and Advanced Age-Related Macular Degeneration, the Eye Disease Case Control Study Group. You might remember this study. It got quite a bit of press at the time. It was done at the Epidemiology Unit of the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary in Boston, and it was published in JAMA, as I mentioned, Volume 272, page 1413 in 1994. And what they were attempting to do is to evaluate the relationships between dietary intake of carotenoids and vitamin A, C, and E, and the risk of neovascular age-related macular degeneration. Now, this turns out to be an interesting study that probably begs the question, why would anyone want to know what the levels of intake of carotenoids would be relative to the appearance of this age-related macular degeneration? What's the association? Why would you even be led to ask that question? And to understand that, we need to go back to look at age-related macular degeneration as the leading cause of blindness in the elderly worldwide. In fact, it affects 30 to 50 million individuals, and the clinical hallmarks of age-related macular degeneration are observed in at least one-third of people over the age of 75 years of age in all industrialized countries. In fact, its cost for management, and as I mentioned, we don't have a good medical treatment really at this point, is over $340 billion annually. So it's a very, very big problem, and it's rising in its prevalence. The majority of age-related macular degeneration patients in the United States are not eligible for clinical treatments, as I mentioned, because we don't have really good late-stage treatments. Therefore, preventive interventions through dietary modulation have risen up to be attractive, and strategies are now designed to try to look at the relationship of specific nutrients and their role in the prevention of injury to the macula. Now, it's really important for us to understand a little bit about the physiology of the macula and the fovea, this center of the retinal area, which, as you probably recognize, the fovea is the only tissue in the body that has a color associated with it due to the selective concentration of a specific nutrient-related carotenoids, or let's call them xanthophylls or pigments. The body doesn't make those pigments. This is a very important point. The body concentrates specific pigments that come from our foods. And our foods, in this case, those pigments are found only in vegetable products. You don't find them in animal products. So individuals said, well, hold it. If macular degeneration is associated with a bleaching of the fovea, meaning loss of the pigments, and those pigments are strictly due to the amount that you consume in your diet, and we think that maybe as people grow older, they don't eat a lot of these dark green vegetables and red and orange fruits and vegetables, that maybe there is a correlation between the lower level of intake of these specific pigments in vegetable products and the increasing risk to age-related macular degeneration. So that was the underlying theme that led in ultimately to this retrospective study looking at dietary carotenoids in the eye disease case control study in Massachusetts. And by the way, there's a very nice review of the molecular aspects of the pathophysiology of macular degeneration that appeared in Molecular Aspects of Medicine in 2012 in volume 33, page 318. So what did they find in the JAMA paper? They found that increasing the consumption of foods rich in the carotenoids, in particular the dark green leafy vegetables that are rich in things like lutein and other xanthophylls, may decrease the risk of developing advanced or exudative age-related macular degeneration, which is the most visually disturbing and disabling form of macular degeneration among older people. So this sat in the literature in 1994. With a call for intervention trials. And, okay, this was an association study, epidemiological retrospective, but does that really mean for sure that people who ate more vegetables with these pigments in them, that they would have decreasing risk of AMD? So over the subsequent years now, going on nearly 20 years, clinical trials have started to appear that have been probing this particular retrospective epidemiological association. And it's that I think we want to speak to, because the results look very encouraging. Now, are they hard iron cast? We know absolutely for sure. I would say no, but directionally, we have some very good information from human intervention trials that certainly point the direction towards the relative understanding of the role that certain nutritional components play in the prevention and maybe even the management of at least earlier stages of AMD. So let's look at some of these studies just in preparation for a discussion with Dr. Kishol. Recently in the Journal of Nutrition, Health and Aging, this is a 2013 issue, volume 17, page 219, a very interesting paper was published looking at biomarkers of oxidative stress in patients with this wet age-related macular degeneration, the most problematic form of it, and finding that people with this condition have an increased oxidative stress condition going on within the eye. And this is a consequence of factors that activate inflammatory processes, inflammation rearing its ugly head once again, in this case with eye pathology. And what they find is that these processes are triggered by the accumulation of various advanced glycosylation end products, or what's sometimes called AGEs, AGEs, advanced glycosylated end products. And where do they come from? They come from the connection of glucose with proteins that then damage these proteins and make them into funny proteins. I call them crusty proteins because this is a little bit like when you bake bread and the sugar in the bread connects with the protein in the dough to then form this crust that occurs after you're baking. So if you think about crusty proteins in your eye, that's not so good. And that can activate this oxidative injury and inflammatory effect. Now, it turns out that these ocular pigments I was speaking to, these vegetable xanthophylls that are concentrated in the fovea of the eye, are found to be antioxidants, and they help to protect against the injury in the eye from oxidative events. They're also photosynthetic, meaning they're photo-reducing pigments that, because of the nature of the eye picking up sunlight all the time, it enhances its oxidative risk just as a consequence of being exposed to light. And you probably know that's why we recommend sunglasses if you're going to be out in a lot of UV radiation exposure, because these wavelengths of light can cause damage in their own respect to proteins in the eye and induce retinal damage and changes in lens opacity that associate with cataracts. So here's another example of multiple effects that could enhance or increase the relative risk of the eye over time, just one day or one month or even maybe one year, but over several years or several decades, to accumulate injury that then accelerates in time and becomes more problematic, that eventually leads to the diagnosis of AMD, which in the later stages, as I mentioned, we don't have really good treatment for. And so the person goes on to, unfortunately, become blind. So can we then use nutrients at some level in this process in supplementary form, or can we change the diet through personalized lifestyle intervention to retard or maybe even turn back this trend towards injury to the eye? And that's the kind of work that's being done now and published. So one of the family of nutrients that's been found for maintaining the structural integrity of the eye and resisting some of these changes that we associate with AMD are none other than our good old friends, the omega-3 fatty acids. So, you know, it's not just like one nutrient. It's not just like, say, oh, everybody take lutein because that's going to be the savior to AMD. No, it's multiple factors that play a role. As I mentioned, if you have insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia and poor glucose management, that can increase the risk. If you have photoexposure, excessively exposing your eyes to UV light, that's another risk. If you smoke, that increases oxidative chemistry in the eye, that's a risk. And in fact, smokers have a much higher incidence of AMD when they grow older than non-smokers. And then we talk about omega-3 fatty acid consumption. If you have a low omega-3, high omega-6 diet, which is the pro-inflammatory fat diet, then you have an increased risk of AMD as well. So all these things accumulate together. It's not just like one factor that's the panacea. So in the Journal of Nutrition in 2013, a very interesting paper was published entitled High Concentrations of Plasma Omega-3 Fatty Acids Are Associated with Decreased Risk of Late-Age Macular Degeneration. This appeared in Volume 143 and page 505. And again, they did some wonderful photography of the eye and looking at the effects of omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids on the prevention of late-age macular degeneration, highlighting the fact that it looks like omega-3 fats are very protective. Now, again, we don't have what I would call definitive intervention trial data yet. And in fact, some of you probably know that there is a little bit of work that's been done by Cochrane. The Cochrane database did do a systematic review of the strength of data on omega-3 fatty acids and AMD, and what they say is that evidence from animal models is strong and observational studies in humans looks very suggestive that increased omega-3 fatty acid intake is associated with lowered risk to injury with AMD, but we are still lacking a good definitive long-term intervention trial. So they're saying it still is speculative and not completely proven. But if you're evaluating options, this might be an option, at least at worst does no harm, to make sure that you've got proper omega-3 fatty acid intake. Now, what about the xanthophylls, these flavonoids that are the pigments, and do they play a role? Of course, here we've got some pretty good intervention trials in humans that have actually started to look at specific doses of intake, like low lutein intake, and it would be something like 10 milligrams a day versus high lutein intake supplements, which are 20 milligrams a day versus placebos, and ask, can you increase the plasma level of these pigments? Can you increase the level in the eye of these pigments by supplementation? And the answer is yes. There's a dose-response graded effect of serum levels of these pigments and ocular levels of these pigments. And you can measure these in the eye, actually non-invasively, using what's called macular pigment optical density. I won't go into the technical, but this is a way you can look into the eye with a specific measuring device, and you can measure the density of these pigments in the eye. And what's found that is the increasing level in the diet, either by supplement or by food, that there is increasing concentration in the eye. Remember I said this is the only place in your body where a pigment is intentionally concentrated selectively for a functional aspect of your physiology. So the body knows what to grab out of your diet and to put in that form in your eye. That is if you're eating it. If you're not eating it, it can't grab it and put it there. So there is a good bit of data saying that intervention trials does show a dose response effect of lutein and also zeaxanthine. Some of you know zeaxanthine is the yellowish golden pigment found in corn. It's the principal colored pigment in corn, whereas lutein is more the principal pigment found in orange-red vegetables and in your dark green vegetables as well. So omega-3 fatty acids and the visual pigment carotenoids and xanthophylls do appear to be very important. Now, what about vitamin A? Because we think of vitamin A, which is converted from beta-carotene by an enzyme in the body that splits beta-carotene into two vitamin A molecules. So people have started to look at vitamin A's relationship to macular degeneration, and it's interesting that vitamin A seems to have some added value to that of carotenoids themselves. Rather than being a pigment, vitamin A, you know, is not colored, but it affects the expression of certain genes. So vitamin A has a specific gene expression response effect through what are called the nuclear orphan receptor family. That's a big term, but what it means is on the nucleus of cells, you have these receptors that are bound to various activating substances, one of which is retinoic acid derived from vitamin A, which is retinol. So your retinoic acid receptor binding site on the surface of your nucleus of cells, like your ocular cells, when stimulated by retinoic acid, that nuclear orphan receptor, which, by the way, co-hybridizes often with 1,25-dihydroxycholate calciferol, which is vitamin D3. So the combination of vitamin D3 and vitamin A as retinoic acid on these receptors activates a family of genes that then are regulating retinal health. So vitamin A plays an important role beyond that just of beta-carotene. And in fact, there's quite a few intervention trials that have been done under controlled conditions in animals, I want to emphasize, showing that graded intakes of vitamin A can have a very positive effect on regulating gene expression of genes that are associated with visual pigment activity like rhodopsin, proteins that are involved with visual acuity like rod arrestin and photophosphodiesterase, transductions, and fatty acid elongases that are all regulated by vitamin A in the retina of the eye. So, again, I want to emphasize vitamin A, carotenoids, xanthophylls, omega-3 fatty acids, staying away from high glycemic load diets, which stimulate too much glucose and insulin activity. And, in fact, there's a very interesting study that's looked at what happens when you modify the glycemic index of diets in animals and the relationship to ocular health, showing that as you go to high glycemic load diets, you get increasing risk of what we would call the animal model for AMD. So again, all these things speak together as to the importance of lifestyle in enhancing or modulating the function of the retina that then helps to prevent in years of service, you know, like 7 decades of living, the relative risk of AMD. So are there nice studies that have been done demonstrating intervention positive outcomes? There's a nice study that was published in the Journal of Ophthalmology in 2012, volume 119, that was an intervention trial with a graded dose of lutein and zeaxanthine, 10 milligrams a day of lutein, 10 milligrams a day of zeaxanthine versus placebo, showing again a trend towards improved visual function and what looked like early stage prevention of AMD. Again, these are short-term trials. you really probably need a much longer term outcome trial to fully nail this down, but you know, you have to go off what you have. So an 8 to 12 week trial is generally the length of most of these studies at this point. There's another paper that was published in the American Journal of Ophthalmology in 2012 that demonstrates improvement of retinal function in early age-related macular degeneration after lutein and zeaxanthin supplementation. And this was a randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled trial in 108 subjects with early AMD, again showing that the 10 milligram per day lutein and 10 milligram per day zeaxanthin combo did associate itself versus placebo in reducing the trend towards advancing AMD. So again, I think this field is still in a state of interesting development of more support for the association between lifestyle, diet, and AMD, but it certainly looks very, very strongly associated, particularly that we now have started to develop a mechanistic understanding of how these pigments work as antioxidants and photoreducing agents that prevent these oxidative injuries to the eye. There's a wonderful paper that it was a review actually in the Free Radical Biology and Medicine in 2012 that talked about the mechanism by which these pigments reduce photooxidative injury and modulate the expression of inflammation-related genes in retinal cells. And as I mentioned, if we just look at the general trend of what's going on right now, if we do nothing, if we just use the available drugs that are on the market today to try to treat this, it's not looking too good. And that was kind of a double entendre, wasn't it? A play on words, not looking too good. Diabetic retinopathy and age-related macular degeneration is increasing almost exponentially in our culture. You know, we're growing older, but we're not necessarily growing older healthily. And blindness is becoming a very, very big problem. There's a paper that was published in 2012 in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, volume 43, page 48, that talks about the high frequency of unawareness among older age people of diabetic retinopathy and its relationship to age-related macular degeneration and how that relates to lifestyle habits. The older age people just do not understand this. It's not been a topic of conversation. Their doctor not discussing it with them. And so it's almost like a firestorm burning uncontrolled. And so either foods that are rich in these pigments or supplements have been found to be valuable. There's a paper published in the British Journal of Nutrition in 2012, volume 108, page 334, that compared nutrient supplements containing lutein and zeaxanthin versus consuming foods that are rich in these pigments, natural foods that could be spinach, for instance, or carrots, and showed that there was value in either of them, either through the supplements or through the foods that are rich in these pigments. And again, I want to emphasize the data says it's a whole body functional effect. If you're a smoker, if you're a high alcohol consumer, if you're an individual who has a lot of pro-inflammatory dietary habits, you're at much higher incidence risk of AMD. And so it's a full change. It's a functional medicine, lifestyle, personalized change that really can turn the tide the other direction. And it's that we'll be talking about with our extraordinary clinician researcher of the month, Dr. Ghashal, who will help take us through a better understanding of what's occurring at the forefront in this very, very important area where the drugs and surgery is not the answer. It appears as if a functional medicine approach using personalized lifestyle medicine is the peremptory approach that we have available today. So with that, let's turn our attention to speaking to a person in the know in this extraordinarily important area. Well, here we are once again. That's the moment I think you and I both wonder, okay, who is the next exciting person we're going to explore some visions of the future with in medicine? And boy, are you up for a real great treat today once again. We've been so fortunate to engage a conversation with a thought leader, an expert who has quite a remarkable background, Dr. Shailesh Ghashal, who is MD, PhD. He was an associate professor at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Ophthalmology is, I guess you would say, his label, although as you'll find, he is far-ranging, broader in terms of his scope of interest and impact than maybe just one medical discipline, because what he's doing, I think, has a significant spreading effect into many other disciplines of medicine from a fundamental heuristic and, I think, didactic and probably even philosophical perspective. So let me tell you just a couple things about Dr. Ghashal that I think you'll find interesting. First interesting point for me, some of you know I had my lineage kind of coming up through the ranks of organic chemistry and then into biochemistry and ultimately into clinical work. So he shares a little bit of an interest in that he got a PhD with a gentleman who I had very, very high respect for back in the 60s and 70s when I was doing a lot of my doctoral and postdoctoral work, Dr. Khurana, who was known for being one of the great organic biological interface transition people. That he not only was an expert in organic chemistry, but he was an expert in biological chemistry and biological systems thinking. So Dr. Kaushal did work as it relates to some of the visual pigments, which he'll be speaking more about, that enters into this whole concept of the outside environment, the photo environment, and its interrelationship to neurology, neurochemistry, ophthalmology, and this gene-environment interaction model is obviously tied through these visual pigments. And then, of course, his medical doctor degree, which has taken him on into being the chairman of the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of Massachusetts School of Medicine, and his work across many different disciplines, both as a clinician and as a researcher, and a very rich publication record that we're going to have a chance to talk about that relates to issues that pertain to some of the major risks that we are seeing develop within the field of ophthalmology, like retinopathy. Some people call this the cratering of Indochina. When you look at the retina of the eyes of some patients, they have these hemorrhagic problems and retinal injury that ultimately leads to the major cause of adult blindness in the United States, and how that interrelates with other age-related problems like age-related macular degeneration. And this concept of sight and vision is a big concern, as you know, as we start to see more and more cases of insulin resistance, hyperglycemia, and the effects of type 2 diabetes. So I think we're right on the edge with Dr. Kaushal of some of the most remarkable questions that will lead to solutions to these systems-related problems. It's probably not just one drug for one disease. It's more a systems approach. So, Dr. Kaushal, thank you so much for being available to Functional Medicine Update and for the remarkable opportunity to get to know you and your work. You are truly a leader in the field. I guess my first question is, how did your path take you down into the field of ophthalmology and this bridging of gaps across the disciplines?
Yes, Jeff, thank you for having me on and taking the opportunity to share some of our thinking and my lab's thinking, my own thinking over the years. So my own educational odyssey, as it were, or training odyssey, really began at first in college, undergraduate, where I always knew I had a passion for math and science. Actually, I wanted to, at one point, be a professional basketball player, being 6'5", but that's a rare event. But I really got turned on by a set of professors in my junior and senior year while I was an undergraduate at Yale University, and then went on to medical school. And really in medical school, I vacillated between a couple different specialties. Neurosurgery was one, and my exposure, particularly during the third year rotations in ophthalmology, with Dr. Irene and Ed Momeny at Johns Hopkins Wilmer Eye Institute, galvanized my, first of all, the excitement about ophthalmology and really the opportunity in that field, the field that I'm in, to take on a career of being a clinician scientist. And their really wonderful, strong encouragement led me to pursue, as you've mentioned already, PhD work with Dr. Gobind Khurana at MIT. And I was absolutely absorbed in the world of research, and I actually had entertained the thought of just pursuing a postdoctoral fellowship as a scientist, but I really missed taking care of people. And that passion to combine my sincere interest in science and eventually in clinical trials as well as so-called translational research and in simultaneously taking care of people led me to do my clinical training first in ophthalmology and then as a retina specialist, did my ophthalmology training out in Los Angeles at the Doheny Eye Institute, USC Medical School, and then my surgical retina and medical retina training in St. Louis at Barnes Retina Institute. And because of that training, I felt I still wanted to spend a little bit more time learning about inherited retinal and macular diseases. And I was very fortunate to be a fellow in London at Moorfields Eye Hospital with Professor Alan Bird and Professor Shomi Bhattacharya. Professor Bird is considered one of the international authorities in inherited retinal and macular diseases, as well as other medical retinal diseases. And Dr. Bhattacharya is also a really outstanding, internationally known basic scientist. So it was there that I started really formulating how I might eventually pursue a career as a clinician scientist.
That path drawing from so many different academic and clinical disciplines gives you a very interesting imprint, I'm sure, on how you look at patients, how you look at their disease. And I would suspicion that it may lend itself very nicely into this systems approach that you've been developing, which we're going to talk more about. Has this been at all a challenge with some of your colleagues who don't have this broad-based perspective that you've developed over your years?
Yes, there's a set of us that have been fortunate or blessed to follow this path, but I'll tell you from my own personal and professional perspective, one of the real beauties of being a retina specialist or an ophthalmologist in general is we can actually observe the biology directly through the microscope, the slit lamp, and by other non-invasive diagnostic testing that we can do, imaging that we can do of the retina. And so what I find particularly satisfying, not only in terms of taking care of patients and helping them improve their vision, but also as a experimentalist, because you can directly visualize at least part of the biology of the disease. And what I really enjoy is seeing patients and then trying to recast some of the biological problems related to the disease into experimentally tractable problems that can be attacked in the lab, or at least pursued in the lab, to try to better understand the disease and or develop potential therapeutics.
So with that as a basis, help us understand what's going on in disease epidemiology related to retinopathy and retinal diseases. We have these inborn diseases that remain maybe reasonably fixed, and then we've got these induced diseases which may be affected by the environment. So where are we in this whole?
Yes. I mean, this is a great question. It's a huge concern both in terms of clinicians taking care of patients with retinal diseases, but even more broadly as the public health problems. As it turns out, for example, diabetic retinopathy, as you're already pointing out, that diabetes in general is rising essentially exponentially across the entire globe. And in addition, as you might imagine, so are the complications related to diabetes. And in my own field as a retina specialist, there's clearly a worldwide shortage of retina specialists because we simply can't manage all the patients that need to be evaluated and or treated for diabetic retinopathy. Likewise, in age neurodegeneration, quickly rising to be the number one cause of blindness in the world. Right now, it's the number one cause of blindness in the Western world for sure. But the incidence in the developing world is also rising quite dramatically. Between those two diseases, which is pretty remarkable in and of itself, it accounts typically probably anywhere for 50 to 70% of a retina practice. In other words, the number of patients that a retina specialist will see are preponderantly patients with diabetic disease or macular degeneration. And that's just those two diseases alone. And remember, there are so many other retinal diseases, some, as you were already hinting, which have a genetic component, and others which are clearly influenced by environment, nutrition, diet, and so on, that are also rising for sure. For example, certain types of vascular occlusions, you can consider them as mini strokes or strokes of the eye. The numbers of those types of patients with those types of disorders is rising as well. We're seeing a tremendous change in the patterns of referrals of patients or the incidence and prevalence of disease in a retina practice, but obviously in a larger sense in medicine as well.
One of the things that I've heard people say, which I don't necessarily agree with, but I'd like to get your much more well-informed opinion, is that these diseases of the eyes that we're seeing, this increased prevalence, is a consequence of the aging of our society. And so this is just a natural consequence of older populations who have older eyes. Is that strictly the answer?
That's a wonderful comment, Jeff, and I would say no. I don't think it's purely an aging event. We know that there's an age-related change in the metabolism of the retina and the eye in general, but the actual manifestation of disease, which is the consequence of aberrant homeostasis, as it were, in the retina, there's clear and mounting evidence of the role of environmental influences and also nutritional influences. Even in our own field, or in my field as a retina specialist, the awareness and understanding of that begun to emerge with lovely epidemiological work done not only here in the U.S. but elsewhere around the world. So it's clear that the profound effect of nutritional and environmental stressors, as it were, on the body in general and the eye as well is increasing. I'd further say, even though I'm a retina specialist and primarily focused on addressing issues of the retina, these diseases that we see with retinal manifestations are really evidence of a systemic disequilibrium or in many, many retinal diseases. And that understanding has started to emerge more clearly, I would say, over the last 10 to 15 years with both wonderful epidemiological work, but also a molecular and biochemical understandings of these disease processes where we see that even though we may directly visualize changes in the retina, we recognize that those types of changes are canonically occurring elsewhere in the body as well.
So that leads to a very, very interesting question. You talk about the disease processes, and your work has helped really to explicate and break through with new understandings of these processes at the molecular and cellular level. And I know that you've been doing quite a bit of work on signal transduction and some of these pathways that get disturbed or modified in their expression. Could you tell us a little bit about things like your heat shock protein work and how you see signal transduction influencing these disorders?
Let me step back and sort of set the stage or a conceptual framework to understand some of this for your listeners. So you might imagine, for example, in the rooms where we're sitting, to feel comfortable, we don't turn the temperature widely 10 degrees one way or the other on the thermostat, which is essentially a rheostat. We just turn it a couple degrees one way or the other to be comfortable in the room. So the reason why I point that out is now think about a cell or a tissue that's stressed either by some environmental influence, for example, cigarette smoke or some nutritional imbalance, right? Or some genetic intrinsic change within the cell. So you can think of that cell, which was previously in equilibrium, now it's sort of off kilter, just like a seesaw that's out of balance. And the real goal of any therapeutic agent is really to allow the cell and the tissue to re-achieve equilibrium. In other words, bring that seesaw back into balance. So that's the fundamental idea around a therapeutic, as we conceive it, and obviously many other folks as well. Now, the other piece of this sort of framework to think about is that if you think of the cell as having a set of multiple pathways, for the moment, you can think of them as little points, and these pathways are connected to each other. You can think of them with springs. And so you might imagine that if you touch on one spring, you know, one particular pathway that's important for cell survival or cell functioning, that when you press on one spring, because all these other springs of these other pathways are connected, that all the other springs will also vibrate. Now, what does that mean in terms of a therapeutic? Well, the way we think of it is instead of targeting a particular protein, what we'd like to do is target a particular pathway. For example, the heat shock protein pathway. There's other pathways that we're interested in as well. And so you might imagine that if you have a therapeutic agent, in other words, a small molecule or a drug, that can affect one of those pathways, because there's this intrinsic intelligence of a cell to rejigger itself back into homeostasis, that if you affect one pathway rather than a single protein, that now you have a chance for that cell to re-equilibrate. In other words, for that seesaw to come back into an equilibrium state where it's straight, you know, parallel with the ground again. And so the concept of these small molecules, I've nicknamed them as molecular rheostats because they're just like a temperature regulator, as it were, thermostat. And the idea is, again, by affecting a pathway, because it's interconnected with other cellular pathways, that this would allow the cell to reestablish homeostasis. And so we've become very interested, as you're pointing out, in the heat shock protein pathway, as well as the role of certain drugs called histone deacetylase inhibitors, like valproic acid, like SAHA and vorinostat, and others, because they allow us not targeting a single protein, but often targeting a pathway and sometimes even multiple cellular pathways.
So this is extraordinarily interesting based on the way that functional medicine has evolved around a systems biology concept, because the way I'm interpreting what you're saying is the imbalances in only a few basic cellular processes give rise to literally thousands of different diseases depending on how they flow through that person's genotype into their phenotype.
That's exactly right.
And then that leads us into the question, okay, if there are only a few of these pathways that ultimately control and regulate multiple outcomes in the phenotype, then what are the determinants for the expression of those imbalances in those pathways or those networks? How do those genes interface with the environment to give rise to the expression that we call that family of diseases? So this sounds to me like a general precept in medicine that you're applying beautifully to retinal diseases, but it seems like it has a very broad-reaching implication.
Yes, absolutely. What I'd say to you, Jeff, is that if I may recast it in my own terms, then that's where I really find the approaches of functional medicine so resonant with what we're thinking in terms of cellular therapeutics. Functional medicine thinks of in terms of overall patient well-being. For example, we know that almost every human disease, there is at least three, four clearly associated biological changes. One is there's oxidative stress. It seems from my own reading and in talking to experts in many areas of medicine and science, there's clear evidence of oxidative stress in almost every human disease. Second, the role of inflammation in human disease processes. And third is the role of the immune system, which is being better appreciated across many, many diseases, including retinal diseases. And then finally, the fourth is the role of cell death. In, at least in science, there's a great interest in apoptosis, or so-called programmed cell death. But there's other forms of cell death as well, necrosis, inflammatory cell death. And then there's something even called necroptosis, where there's inflammatory programmed cell death. You can think of it that way. So those four or five canonical principles of disease at a cellular level or at a tissue level, I think resonate very well with the concepts of functional medicine that Jeff, you and others have developed and have now starting to be practiced across the country and elsewhere.
This is very, very exciting. So let's take this now to your work, which I think has been pioneering work, to look at how this construct translates into searching out for a drug that will treat a specific ocular disease. How does that then guide your research and guide maybe therapeutics as we look downstream as to how we're going to better manage this exploding prevalence of these conditions?
Yeah, this is at the level of experimental science. That's the real challenge of it all. Let me just, again, I'll share with you some of the ideas we've developed. Obviously, there's other folks who are thinking in similar lines as well. We're just fortunate we have a model system that Mother Nature has gifted the human and our mouse models eyes that are easily observable and easily quantifiable in terms of what may be happening at the level of the biology of the retinal tissue. So experimentally, what we had set up and completed was to use the power of robotic screening, in other words, high-throughput screening in multiple assays. We're looking for molecules that have the properties of, one, being antioxidants, two, that they're anti-inflammatory, third, they should have some ability to prevent cell death, and then fourth, like I was mentioning before, of those canonical aspects of human disease, that they should have some ability to modulate the immune system. At first glance, that may be a tall order if you look at it at the surface, but it turns out quite interestingly, in nature solved many of these problems of these therapeutics with natural plant products and herbs as well. And many of them, as some of your listeners may be familiar, Jeff, and you may be familiar as well, they're called adaptogens. And these types of natural small molecules, or drugs if you'd like to call them that, are produced by plants and herbs to allow them to survive in unusual climates, right? Unusual cold and unusual heat. as it turns out, they have very, very interestingly these types of properties that I've just mentioned that could be useful as therapeutics in human disease. Part of the attraction of all of this to me is because they're natural, they can be consumed either as the native plant or herb, or in some instances, the natural product has been isolated. In fact, that's what we originally discovered. And you might imagine that since nature has developed these literally evolutionarily over thousands and maybe even hundreds of thousands of years, that they must have certain intrinsic biological safety, which turns out to be true, right? And without getting into the real nitty-gritty specifics of it all, the excitement to me is this interfaces directly with some of the concepts and approaches that functional medicine takes. In other words, using natural products, or if you want to recast it in a slightly different way, one might imagine having these versatile small molecules that affect potentially, as I've mentioned, multiple pathways and thereby mitigating multiple aspects of disease manifestation, or as Jeff, as you were describing, the phenotype. And so this approach to me is conceptually very satisfying, and we believe it may be the future of therapeutics in the not so distant future, as it were. What I want to point out is how it contrasts with the way typical approaches in academia and the pharmaceutical industry are. Typically, what happens is a protein of target is identified to participate in some aspect of the disease process. And the idea is to develop a biological agent. It could be an antibody or a small molecule, a drug, that binds with extremely high affinity. Often the idea is to have something with nanomolar binding affinity for that protein of target. And basically you load up the cell or the human being with that drug in order to affect or change the cadence of the disease pattern. And what we're suggesting is slightly different. And that is, first of all, that you don't need large concentrations of the drug, and thereby you limit the potential toxicity. And then secondly, and more importantly, as I said before, but repeat again, is the idea is that you're rejiggering the cell into homeostasis by affecting a pathway or other multiple pathways within the cell that allow it to then re-equilibrate or reacquire homeostasis.
I think this is an unbelievably interesting merging of what I guess some people would call traditional medical thinking from both traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine with Western medicine.
Yes.
It's a very powerful mixing of models into a systems biology model that addresses pleiotropy, it addresses redundancy, it addresses complexity, and it's less involved with single hits of single targets as it is modulating systems of disturbed function. So it's a really powerful concept. And have you had any, in your models of retinal disease, have you had any successes in showing
this? Yes, Jeff. We've been very fortunate to literally take things from cell culture, animal models, into humans. In fact, I've been very fortunate to present some of this work at our national and international retina meetings. The first time I presented it a couple of years ago, there was less interest. And as you know, as there's more use and also additional work that's done in the area, there's greater interest and also greater scientific validation of the approach. So, you know, my colleagues are now starting to use the therapeutics, or at least one therapeutic we've identified, and we're obviously keen to replicate that. So at least we have one proof of concept, and now we're seeking to others some natural products to bring those to clinical use in retinal diseases and see if they also literally allow us to go from bench, again, from cell culture and animal models into humans to affect the disease process itself. The other very tantalizing idea or possibility is, and I think, Jeff, you already hinted at it earlier, is in part because these disease pathogenetic events are conserved by Mother Nature. In other words, let me say it in a slightly maybe easier way that we follow it, is that when a cell or tissue, whatever it may be, heart, lung, liver, brain, eye, bone marrow, muscle, when that cell is stressed by whatever environmental or genetic factors, Mother Nature only has a constrained set of options by which she tries to deal with that disease. And if it isn't able to deal with that stressor, then that becomes manifest as a disease of, for example, the muscle or the heart or lung or liver, as I was pointing out. So one might imagine these types of molecular rheostats, not only, you know, we've used the retina as a platform for discovery, but also they have potential utility in other diseases. Is that true? Well, at least in the mouse models we've explored of non-retinal diseases, like of the lung, of the pancreas, like diabetes, and also heart disease, those same set of molecules that are modulating and affecting retinal diseases, at least in our mouse models, appear to be effective in these other diseases. And that would be consistent with our thinking of how a molecular rheostat should work.
Yes, I'm thinking a compound like resveratrol, which has received a tremendous amount of attention over the last decade, which we know is a histone deacetylase modulator and has effects on sirtuin gene families and mammalian target of rapamycin or mTOR. That would be kind of a candidate that we might think of from peanut skins or from grape skins that could be such a candidate for this model that you're describing.
Absolutely. In fact, maybe it was rather telepathic of you, but that is one of the molecules we haven't published that work yet. We've presented it as the poster, but we've identified it as a compound that clearly affects the cells of the retina in terms of protecting them.
This is taking my reading of some of your publications to maybe a level of abstraction, so I apologize if I'm leaping too far, but I'm very interested in your work on Leber's optic neuropathy because that's a constitutive mitochondrial deletion disorder that's genetically inherited through the maternal linkage. But it also has a very interesting model to bioenergetics and how that interrelates Leber's optic neuropathy to myopathies and to encephalopathies because these conditions kind of come in groups of families to talk about your multi-target types of tissues. So have you had any experience in your molecular rheostat model looking at something that's as constitutive, intrinsic, as Leber's optic neuropathy, which is a mitochondriopathy?
Right. I think you're thinking of our published work on Leber's congenital amaurosis. That's where we've had some degree of success with gene therapy, and that's a disorder of the retina, which affects photoreceptor function. But your thinking about Leber's optic neuropathy is correct that it is a mitochondrial disorder. I don't have direct experience with that disorder.
But the reason I'm asking the question is that it strikes me from the extraordinary work that you've done, the systems biology approach, that this may interface ultimately at a mechanistic level with bioenergetics at the mitochondrial level.
Absolutely, Jeff. That's a true statement for sure. In fact, you know, in the midst of writing a prospectus on the future of retinal therapeutics, which also has implications, obviously, for other areas as well. But this whole concept of cellular homeostasis, which is just, as you pointed out, I think it requires a systems biological approach to really embrace not only the complexity and nuance of disease, but also by embracing that complexity, one can think about therapeutics like molecular rheostats. And again, I wouldn't say that that's the only approach, you know, the one we're taking. There may be other approaches as well. But it has to, coming back to your comment, it has to embrace the importance of energy metabolism for sure, because nearly every single disease process, at least as my own reading of literature, is that there's clearly effects on this dysregulation of energy metabolism. In other words, the efficiency with which a cell may produce ATP or the way that the cell may process or use that ATP in various energetic or biological machines that exist in the cell.
So let me, if I can, talk about one last area that I know you have much more depth of understanding than I, but I think it interrelates with everything you're talking about, and that's the macular degeneration and its relationship to visual pigments in the fovea and this lutein connection to diet and what people are trying to understand as a photodesensitizer, which are these pigments that are concentrated in the tissue, which are kind of unusual that the body picks a certain chromophore to concentrate.
Yes.
So could you tell us a little bit about how that fits into this model of molecular rheostats? Because it seems like it's another example of your concept.
Yes, Jeff, that's right. So macular degeneration, just in terms of a little bit of clinical medicine, as I was mentioning earlier, is quite common, at least in the Western world. It's the number one cause of blindness, and it's rising throughout the world. And it comes in two basic forms, and they're actually, I think forms may be a less correct term. It comes on a spectrum of disease, and you can think of it almost like an autism spectrum. But there's a so-called dry form or non-exudative form where there's an absence of abnormal new blood vessels that are growing underneath the retina. And then there's the so-called wet form or the exudative form where there are examples where patients develop neoangiogenesis, new blood vessels that are growing within or underneath the retina. And that disease, it's clear that there are multiple critical pathogenetic events that occur in that disease. And some of them I already mentioned in the general context of human disease. But we know that, again, oxidative stress, clearly inflammation, and in the case of the eye, photo-oxidative stress, in other words, excessive light exposure, we know that there's also evidence of immune dysregulation that occurs in the retina and in the body that can participate in the disease process, to name at least a few of the critical pathogenetic events. So the whole idea of molecular rheostats, frankly, was born out of trying to understand or embrace the complexity of the disease itself and some of the beautiful biology that's been understood by many groups around the world, as well as our own group, in the context of this disease. And so this whole concept of molecular rheostat, as I was saying, really was born out of trying to understand how one could potentially treat macular degeneration. And we've identified a set of natural compounds and, in fact, also FDA-approved drugs, like some of the histone deacetylase inhibitors that you were mentioning earlier, and heat shock inducers as well, which we believe could be used to help treat this systemic disease with eye manifestations.
I can tell you that I know we have just touched the tip of the iceberg with this discussion, the depth of your understanding and the way that you're using these conditions of the eye to explore and probe a general thought about the origin of chronic degenerative diseases is absolutely, to me, at the forefront of moving from a pathology-based form of medicine to a mechanistic form of medicine. So I want to thank you so much, both for your work and the way you describe it and for your advocacy. I know that this must be a very exciting time for you, but it probably is also very challenging because you're trying to help people to understand, guide them to understand this new model, which is kind of different than the model that many of us learned, which was a memorization model of histopathology and cytology and histology. And now we're really talking about mechanisms that underlie the appearance of these conditions that ultimately fan out to be thousands of diseases in our DRG book. So I really want to applaud what you're doing, and I think every listener of this discussion with you has come away saying, wow, no matter where we look in the body, if you look at the expert who's understanding the mechanisms of disease, they all tend to converge on a single model, which is very, very exciting.
Yes, yes, I think so. Again, Jeff, I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to share with you some of the ideas that have been percolating in our thinking over the last 3 to 5 years.
Well, I'm looking forward for the opportunity to have a chance to meet you at the upcoming Functional Medicine Annual International Conference. I'm sure that you're going to infect the IFM population with a lot of great new thoughts and bring this concept of eye-related diseases much more into the forefront of the thinking within the functional medicine community. So thank you so, so much, Dr. Kashal, for sharing all this with us today. Well, I hope that your takeaway from this edition of Functional Medicine Update was as powerfully important as it was for me as the person that had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Kashal. You know, having parents that are aging and having more and more association with 80 and 90-year-old individuals who are losing their sight and wondering why it's happening to them, it's a very real topic. It's not just a theoretic topic. And so what are we going to do about this? How are we going to reduce this burden? How are we going to improve function of people whose minds are still good, their bodies are still active, but they are becoming blind, and it's preventable? So I think this is a very, very interesting topic, and I hope one that we'll all take as news to use. We'll look forward to visiting with you in the May issue of Functional Medicine Update.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis by Jeffrey Bland, LLC. Reproduction in any form other than for personal use is prohibited.